Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. And thanks for joining us today. This is another episode. Kirk and I have just spent a half hour, 45 minutes, and I wish we would have hit record.
Right.
Every now and then we catch each other and go, wait a minute. We got to put that on the tape.
Well, Fred and I have been discussing that. Of course, he's written a lot of articles about MTBF. We all know that he is, and I am certainly opposition to using that as a metric for reliability or any other reason to use
it. Pretty much anything.
And it's not better than nothing. It is actually more destructive than nothing. In my view, because it causes you to do things that may not be relevant to improving any reliability because of the models.
If you read that article, it really just says, you know, if somebody comes to you and asks about MTBF, it's not that you want to use MTBF or any methods or models to create MTBF. It's better than them not asking about reliability in any form or fashion. At least now you can educate them. So that's the gist of my intention better than nothing, because if you're working with a team and they're like, oh, you're the reliability guy, go away, we don't deal with that, right? It's a non-starter, right? Whereas if they come to you and say, hey, what's the MTBF estimate for our product? You can start saying, well, one, don't use MTBF. That's really meaningless what you're asking. Two, you're an idiot. Three, you know, we'll probably skip that part. But why do people ask that question? They're asking, well, how good is our product? Is it good enough? Right? They need to make that decision. If you ship a product, is it good enough? If I ship a product and they all fail in 3 months and it's supposed to last a year, you know, you're out of business. That product line's a flop.
Absolutely. Right? But those things, in my view, in a general statement, the things that fail that are solid state electronics that fail within a 3-year period. This is semiconductors or passive components. There is something fundamentally flawed in producing that product.
Well,
okay?
It's not
the standard known intrinsic mechanisms that cause wear.
I agree. It's not like electromigration or NTBI or all these other ones, but it's the design is putting too much current across the trace that's not designed to carry that current.
It's an overlooked design margin issue. It's overlooked. Yeah. It's a mistake.
No, but you still need to know, do you have those? Is it good enough to last a year? Now, if I'm putting something in space and it's got to last for 20 years for it to be useful, or I'm putting it under a hood of a car and it's got to last 20 years, you know, and it's super expensive to replace it if you don't, you know, then you worry about longer term stuff. But if it's a 1-year product, and you often talk about, Kirk, the consumer products, right? And the obsolescence, the new technologies.
Technological obsolescence, it comes much before any intrinsic mechanism, especially in semiconductors or solder cracking or anything else in a solid circuit board that does not have moving parts.
No battery. No, I agree. But the issue is it doesn't matter if I'm making just a simple electronic circuit for a product. At some point, somebody's going to ask in the organization, and it is a very, very fair question, will this last long enough with low enough failure rate that we'll be okay? Now, we're not talking about long term, right? It's a 1-year product.
It's not a huge thing.
But if I give a product, you know, and I worked on a product that was typifies this problem, right?
Okay.
So this solid
state electronic product that has no moving parts.
Right. It had a connector, right? They plugged it in every now and then, but the connectors themselves didn't fail.
I'd focus on that.
No, but the connector actually didn't fail. It was a standard.
All right.
What do they call it? Audio port or whatever, and it did everything. It did it. That part never had a problem.
Okay.
But it was a hand or a wearable product.
Okay.
Right. And so the before I got involved, the design team said, "Well, we got to make sure it works." And so they said, "Well, how do people use it? Where do we expect them to use it?" And they were wanted it to be water resistant.
Okay.
Right. And you know, water and electronics and voltage and corrosion and stuff like that, it's usually not a great deal. It's not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing.
It's not immediate. And
no.
If you don't seal it right or make sure it works, it will probably fail if it gets too wet. And so,
right.
And it was a very simple little product. It had a couple of sensors, it had some little itty bitty microchip kind of thing, and a mm-hmm. little, kind of indicator okay. lights and a few lights and a few other things. And it tracked, it was like a tracking out your fitness when you're walking and doing stuff.
Okay.
Like that. And it was early on in the market for
okay.
that.
Okay.
Right. And so somebody said, "Hey, will this work for the year?" And so they said, "Well, we could all just wear them for a year. That one worked for a couple of weeks. So yeah, I think it'll be good." And well, let's check it. And so in line with a lot of what both you and I talk about a lot is, well, they went out and they dropped it and they threw it on the wall and they banged it into the wall. They plugged it in and unplugged it a whole pile of times. But then they said, "Well, what about water?" So they went to a standard. It's a whole topic for another episode. But yes. They went to a standard for wristwatches.
Okay.
Right. And wristwatches, you know, you can buy a watch that says it's water resistant for diving, right? Divers wear
right.
watches.
Right.
And it goes down, you know, so many feet and meters of depth and pressures and all this stuff.
Right.
So they said, "Well, we're not advertising this thing for diving. But somebody can take a shower, wash their hands, go swimming. It should be okay. So let's make sure it's resistant to water for 3 meters. Which is right. overkill, right?
Right.
And it was like a corner case that somebody would be scuba diving with this thing, but a pool would be, and showers would be reasonable.
Right.
Right. So they took it over to the sink, and they stuck it under the sink,
right.
and they washed it a bunch, and,
yeah.
you know, did this stuff, and they tapped off the water, and it was still working.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine. Yep. So then they went to the watch standard.
Passed.
Well, right. So they went to the watch standard.
We're happy.
They went to a standard, which in the watch industry, they have a whole series of standards.
Right.
And it said, essentially do the same thing, but put it in, if you're resistant to 3 meters, put it in 3 meters of water.
Right.
And it was like for 10 seconds,
mm-hmm.
pull it up, shake the water off and see if it works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. What they failed to notice or consider was, well, how does water make electronics fail?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, first off, if you use really clean water, there's nothing conductive there, and it'll just dry off and not leave any corrosive or conductive elements to cause any problems. It would be fine. We'd all
to a point,
right? To a point.
If you use distilled water,
right?
If you use absolutely pure water, it will eat traces, and we had that in an ion implanter because we had to cool down. At 200,000 volts, we circulated water from 200,000 volts to ground. So that water had to be absolutely pure because, right. as we know, water is absolutely pure water is a very, very good insulator, proven by the fact that this ion implanter could have a cooling system that would run from ground to a 200,000 volt elements and then back to ground without shorting. We use polyflow tubing and, you know, had double filtration systems to make sure that there was no contamination in the water. Otherwise, mm-hmm. we'd have a short. And when we unfortunately disconnect one of the distilled water are the tubes mm-hmm. and splash a little water on a circuit board, that was at risk for being etching because I believe, I don't know if it's a little bit basic or a little bit acidic, but absolute pure water will cause eating up traces.
Well, isn't water in water in general is just like a really, really good solvent. It takes apart other things just by its nature.
Yeah, it's got to absorb other, you know, it takes in other ions or other...
anything that's free, and then it cascades, right? So anyway, these guys thought they were all good. We did the standard. It's lovely. It passed. And what they didn't notice is that a week later, none of those samples worked anymore. But they were doing all kinds of stuff. They were throwing off buildings. They were, you know, driving over it. And so they weren't surprised they weren't working, but they didn't then do the next step, which I think you and I agree on, is, well, why did it stop failing? And if they would have opened up their device, they would have found all this corrosion and go, wait a sec, that's not mechanical damage. That's something else. Where'd that come from? And then they back it up to water. But there are things that in the design process, right, it doesn't matter. I was just working with a startup the other day, and they were going absolute dirt cheap, counterfeit parts galore, whatever they could scrounge out of the back of their TV set. You know, this one group, they were, you know, they were taking apart wheelchairs for controllers, abandoned electric wheelchairs. They were taking components off of that. But the point of what they were doing was, we just need to see if this concept works. And what they were asking me about was, then when we really make this thing, what do we need to do? I says, well, first off, you know, don't hand solder all this stuff yourself. You guys are not good at it.
Well,
you know, make sure
any hand operation is going to be much more unreliable than a.
That's right. But that's where they were asking me, what's going to make this last for a year? It says, well, it's reduce the variability and be very consistent in the process of assembly.
What were they expecting to fail in a year, Fred?
Oh, they couldn't get one to work more than 3 hours. They had all kinds of design issues too. This op amp we got here, you know, this linear, this diode keeps smoking. And it says, well, you're using a diode that's only rated for a quarter watt, and you're putting five watts through it.
Are they using automated circuit analysis? You know, there's
No. They had a piece of paper, and they draw a little sketch, and they go build it.
They're not using any design for reliability, or even thought about reliability as far as, or even good design rules.
No, okay. But you've seen really good companies, big companies, right? That don't have design rules. Don't think they throw it over the wall to the test guys and say, "Are you fit? You make it reliable." That can happen in a big company.
Maybe so. Maybe.
It's rare.
I don't know. I see them all following the standard rules and applying them to, you know, known failure mechanisms. They avoid and design away from failure. In most cases,
and most designers try to do that. Yeah, not always, but most designers do. And part of it is what span of things are they designing away from? What do they know about? So, like, this handheld thing,
they design away from what they know,
right?
And that's what I'm saying. The models are only what you know.
It's standard parts, though. They're off the shelf. They're just regular stuff.
Standard parts. Okay, let's take a semiconductor IC. Okay. Basic thing. It's got four major mechanisms that drive it to wear out failure. Electromigration.
We're not talking about. It's 1 year. It's 1 year. What causes an IC to fail within a year?
We don't. There are all kinds of manufacturing flaws or variations in manufacturing or mistakes in manufacturing.
Or handling. Or
design.
Bending
or
it.
Or handling. ESD.
ESD. Mechanical damage. Overvoltage. Driving the current wrong.
Absolutely.
Right.
And all those things are not in the models. I mean, they're not saying, okay, your chance of having a mistake like that in your – maybe you can use some historical average. We had this many mistakes in our last design, and we'll have this many mistakes in the future. But I don't think that you can know where those mistakes are. I don't think you can know in advance. And those are the things that I would argue are the most costly to all companies.
But how do you answer the question then? How do you answer the question? These guys, these startup folks, right, or just any product, they come to you and say, hey, look, Kirk, this product's only going to last a year. We got a 3-month warranty on it. it's a new design. We're using standard parts. We're using the, you know, our existing design practices. Can you help us understand, will it last for a year with a relatively low failure rate? How would you go about answering that question?
I would say it will last. I will show them equations for the intrinsic mechanisms that are inherent to it and make assumptions about the activation energy of these mechanisms, which are just completely pulled out of the air within a range.
Well, that's physics of failure. And then,
I said. Right, right. Well, that's the only thing that causes. Anyway.
Well, how does that tie to early life failures that we typically see?
I don't think you can predict early life failures that you typically see. I don't think those are things. If they were, we would eliminate them. I don't believe that.
I disagree with that completely.
All the issues that cause latent defects which are manifested as failures early in the life, or latent defects, not wear out modes or intrinsic.
No. I disagree. And part of this was a test of failure, like a halt I was doing on a product, right? But what we found was this wiring. They routed last minute. They changed a battery wire from the cabinet to the circuit board, and it was luckily we had that in the prototype we were using in the halt chamber.
Okay,
right now, you know as well as I do that we'll find stuff in halt testing, and some of it was like there's so much margin there. You hit it with 800-pound hammer, of course it's going to break. But it didn't break until then. So that's cool.
Right.
We're not going to fix that. So we started vibration. I think it was at 5 GMRS. It was relatively minor, right?
Okay.
And within about 3 minutes, it failed. The battery completely discharged.
Okay.
It just dead short.
Okay.
Right? And, you know, that's usually not a good thing.
Okay.
Right?
What was the failure mechanism, Fred?
So the wire rubbed the top of the circuit board, and it happened to be, get this, the positive lead of the battery wire happened to be right over the ground plane, right?
Right.
And so it wore through the little bit of coating that covers the traces on the circuit board, which the designer thought would be enough insulation to keep them separate.
Okay.
But when you add a little bit of vibration, now this was a handheld device that was part of its activity was going to be clapped and shaken and all that.
This one on the wrist. Okay.
No. This wasn't a wrist one. This is a different product, a different handheld.
All right. So anyway.
And so the designer made an assumption in the design using basic type stuff they're doing. And it's a circuit board and a battery wire. And it was designed by an electrical engineer.
Right.
But
he overlooked
the
amount of
resisted the wear of the insulation that they were getting.
With consumption of a basic reservoir material, which was the thickness. Right, okay.
And now we don't have a model for that. We could have analyzed it and said, you know, every millimeter of motion and every G of motion, we'd wear this micron off. And we didn't. We just changed the design so we didn't have that contact there.
Right. But within every one of those parameters, there is a distribution too.
Right. And so what I had like one sample that showed it, and the program manager said, well, what's the probability this will happen on every design? He wanted to know, is this like only a corner case that only if you put it in a halt chamber, it'll happen? Will this happen everywhere? And that's a fair question.
He didn't. The first thing I would have said, how can we improve the life or this mechanism? How can we increase the length? How much does it cost?
It's too late. It's too late. You know how it is. You get the protos way late, and he's like,
right.
Is this if this affects a certain percentage of our products with some probability of that occurring? He was asking a statistical question. Like you said, things vary, different vibration varies, different thicknesses vary, all those things vary.
Right.
We had 30 seconds to convince him that, you know, this wear will happen in transit, in use, and anytime it is vibrating, this mechanical action will occur. I can't tell you that 3% will fail after 2 weeks or 40% will fail in a year, but they all will fail.
Yes.
And then he said, okay, we have to solve that. Now, if I had the same evidence and I had, you know, that it took us to 50 GRMS and it took us 6 hours in high vibration to get even the slightest wear pattern on there.
Right.
I would have said, no, you got a lot of margin. You're fine.
Right. Right. It's more than you need. It's more than you need. And he may say, well, how can we reduce? We want to reduce the cost of this. How can we take some of that more than we need and bring it down to? And I've had that question in a computer company. I've had saying, well, it'll run, that motherboard will run to 135C. We don't need that. We don't need it to be able to do that.
Let's make it
cheaper. Can we make it cheaper? And I said,
turn the
fan
off.
These are all standard components. These are all just, you know, off the shelf stuff.
Wrap it in a blanket. Special. Wrap it in a blanket. Right, right, right. And cover it in, you know.
Why would you want to do that? You can't risk it. And that's the whole issue, Fred. And this is what I want to talk about is if we were to re-engineer or recreate reliability engineering today, and you were somebody were to hand you an Apple or a Samsung smartphone, and it has no buttons, it has no moving parts in it, it has no plugs, no sockets, nothing, no wires that move. You open it up, it looks like a little tiny bunch of little tiny plastic bricks. Okay, now excluding the battery, which we haven't overcome the issue of a wear outing of a battery wearing out. Mm-hmm. We haven't found that technology yet. Okay. Excluding the battery and any mechanical buttons on that device, what with a guy not knowing any knowledge about anything, he knows silicon, he knows some of the intrinsic mechanisms, and he knows, from what I know, is a lot of those mechanisms we don't know because we haven't ever tested them to normal wear out modes, or they haven't existed long enough to ever reach those, and we haven't seen those. Okay. And you're going to ask him, how long will this last? Will this last 5 years without, with less than 1% failure? And he would ask you, well, what kind of environment, what is your environmental life cycle profile for this?
How is it used?
And the designer says, well, it's going to be used everywhere a human might be, and Antarctic to the desert
to
and
Mars.
It might be even worse than that because a human might drop it or might do that,
right.
And so you're going to have to take all those factors into consideration to come up with a number. Tell us how long, how many will fail. And Fred,
I can do that. I have done that. And it was actually pretty accurate. I using just one simple example, this handheld device. One of the handhelds that I worked with years ago, one of the main risk of the product and the way it was going to be used, it would be dropped or thrown and it would hit something. It hit somebody else, or it hit the wall or the TV or the concrete or the floor or whatever, right?
Okay.
And it wasn't just a simple accidental drop. The way it was used, it was swung around and people were clapping. It was a party controller type thing.
Okay. You know, and
so I said, all right, let's just walk through what's the day in the life of this product, right? Vast majority of time, it's just sitting in a box or on the shelf or wherever, and chance of it failing or zero, because nobody's dealing with it unless a meteor hits it. And that's a really, really small thing, and we're not even going to calculate it. All right. How often do you expect, and this, I went to the marketing guys, and so how often do you expect people to use these, and for how long, and how many people? And so we started piecing that through, and we went through, you know, one person plays with it once on Christmas morning, and then they never use it again on one end of the distribution. The chance of it failing for them by them dropping it, was really, really small. We just put a number in saying there's one in a million, you know, one in 500,000 chance they do it. And it was just an estimate, absolute guess, right? And then we went to the other end. Somebody's going to take it out of the box and throw it through a plate glass window and then into the fireplace. The chance of that happening again is very, very low. But then we backed it up to say, all right, so somebody uses it. They get together with their friends on Friday night. They get a pizza and they play this game and they dance and they party and they throw it around. And there's six or eight people there and they hand it off to each other. It bounces off the couch. And we started saying, well, and at that point, then it was the early prototypes with the marketing guys is they went and watched people using this stuff in similar products. And they counted how many times it was dropped from and what angle and speed. So I knew I needed to get a profile of how often it would go and understood that it was going to be a distribution. But we started to to mark out where that distribution was. And then we went and quantified. We said, well, how much force does this thing see when it just rolls off the coffee table or when somebody sits on it or when it's over their head and dropped? How much force does it actually see? And then we started nailing down, well, how much force does it take to break this stuff, to crack? Mm-hmm. We actually had crystals, the little can crystal on, right, on circuit boards. They broke the crystal because of, right, the shock loading it was seeing.
Right, and that's a mechanical system.
It's just a piece of glass, like a saran. It's a piece of glass. And we were, right, breaking.
But it has to vibrate.
It was a shock, but it's, right, a handheld product. It's going to see shock.
Okay, right.
Circuit.
Right.
Now, the other, okay, thing that we broke, and this one we actually predicted with a CAD model. We did a finite element model and said, given,
right,
the type of motion it's seeing, this circuit board is, right, not anchored correctly, and it will crack the IC, the main chip, which, right, was like a quarter inch square. But, right, because of where the motion was, we said, you need to move it because it's at the worst possible place on the circuit board.
Okay.
It's going to fracture. And they're like, no, right, way. It's in a case. It's got leads. It's a blah, blah, blah. And, mm-hmm, all of a sudden, it never happened. It won't bend that way, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So we showed them the model. And we said, that's too much force for that fragile of a IC chip.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And a thin piece of silicon is just a piece of glass.
Yes.
Right. And so they didn't believe us. So we went off and we did all the analytical work and trying, mm-hmm, to do so what it's got to survive and all this stuff. And of course, we broke them right there.
Yeah.
And we even caught one of them on a high speed camera, the waveform, right, that this thing was doing when it was seeing shock that mirrored the CAD program. And so, mm-hmm, out of this analysis and all of the measurements and strain and stress and shock, mm-hmm, and loading and all the other stuff, mm-hmm, we did, we said you're going to have about an 8% failure rate in the first year from these risks. And it wasn't just, mm-hmm, drop damage, but those risks, right, in general. And they were at 7.4.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good, Fred.
You know, it can be done. And it was only focusing on things that would happen in the first year.
I'd say you have a product, and it sounds like a game controller of some sort that would be a very much more limited than, say, what a smartphone is expected. The distribution and the number.
Across
the world.
I know we're running a little bit long, but again, it was an electronic reader type thing. I got pulled in, and we're doing the first kind of just get me up to speed with the thing.
Yes.
Right. And I looked at it and I said, how many times is your main graphics card, your main GPU, which is this big honking silicon component in the middle of the board, how often does that fail for you? Is that like your leading cause of failure? And I'd been in there 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they all went dead silent and looked at me like, how did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I looked at it and where it was located on the board and the way they mounted it and how, mm-hmm, it was a L-shaped board.
Mm-hmm.
Without getting into details, you could just look at it and go, that's going to break.
Right.
And it did over and over and over again.
Right.
For him.
And I think any engineer that has been through a lot of failure analysis or seen a lot of experienced a lot of design flaws like that or overlooked design weaknesses, mm-hmm, in there is able to do that. And I did that too. When, right, before I would test anything and halt, I would overview the whole board and the structure and connections and what was, capacitors that were not properly laid down or
seated or attached.
Yeah, exactly. And you know those things are going to be weaknesses that mechanical vibration do. But you can't really see the weaknesses inside the chip and electrical weaknesses and mechanisms silicon.
Yeah, and that's why we look at process control. We look at how they're building the thing, who's building it, and we look at the test of failure. Let's go push this thing. Let's add voltage until something breaks and see what happens.
Right. Yeah. And that's why I'm saying that all these things are overlooked or not realized. And obviously this might have been one of their first designs. They hadn't had any experience with that particular configuration in the field because they would have known if they'd had field feedback that mechanism was going to cause close to 8% failure rate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whether that obviously that was acceptable for them to ship with that kind of failure rate or not.
Yeah, and I'm making up the numbers to protect the guilty.
Yeah, it's another
you know, problem. But it was within like 6 points of the actual failure rate, and it was actually pretty close.
I think that especially for mechanical issues of fatigue, mechanical fatigue, fatigue braking, those kinds of things, we can look at them, but there's no real model for that because a design, you know, like your rubbing of a wire and insulation in that.
Yeah, but that's the kind of thing that kills us early on, right? Those design overlooks and everything else. And we still need to quantify it in some fashion, right? We need to say, yeah, it's 80% or better is going to survive the year. Is that good enough for you?
Well, I'd say again, looking at a smartphone today and removing all the mechanical issues, it is almost a brick. It is almost a brick. It's almost solid. The whole device is so packed, so tight. There's not much room for movement, you know, inside those devices, not much displacement.
Yeah.
And so everything else in that is really based on, you know, basically what the intrinsic life in the mech, in the screen, the LCD, the whatever
I agree with you. There's a lot of intrinsic stuff, but I would also look very, very closely at the assembly process and looking for latent defects.
Absolutely.
You know, bending cables, all those kinds of fretting still happens in
and
a solid
thing.
At
any point, one of your tiers of suppliers can send you a component that they don't know has a latent defect mechanism because their process variation or they had a quote excursion and they didn't realize it and it would affect
pass right through.
Especially the aluminum electrolytics that it would kill thousands and there was no model for the mistake of the electrolyte being mixed.
Oh, red phosphorus is back. Remember that?
Yeah. So these things come and go, just like tin whiskers. We knew about tin whiskers decades ago.
Oh, yeah.
And suddenly when they went to lead-free, oh, wow, we got a tin whisker problem now. And so that, you know, it's that mechanism is eliminated, not trying to keep it from happening. And now we have an understanding of, especially through Kaus's work, a bigger, much better understanding of tin whiskers and how to prevent them.
So anyway, I think you still need to quantify it. I agree with you completely, Kirk, that it's not out of a handbook or over looking at the physics of failure models of wear out, especially when you're trying to answer a question of in the relatively short term. Then it's process control and variability. What's failing in your prototypes? Because that's likely to keep failing for you. And then look through the day in the use of or the day in the life of your product. And what are the range of stresses that you're going to see? And where do they go? And it's kind of things we would do to lead up to a halt test anyway, right? But at the end of the day, we need to provide some quantification to say, oh, this is a 1% problem. Oh, no, this is an 80% problem. Because we can say, hey, this is going to fail, but the people we're working with need to know, well, to what extent, how many are going to fail in order for them to make a good decision. So coming out of halt, we're going to say, no, yeah, this failed in halt, but it's unlikely to fail, very low failure rate in the field. We have to quantify that to some level for them to make good decisions. I'd love to be able to come out of halt and say, oh, you got an 18.7 thousand hour MTBF. I'm just being facetious there. See if I get you going. But we don't. We can't say it's going to be a 98.3% reliability after 2 hours of testing.
Fred, you gave some good mechanical fatigue examples.
There's chemical processes.
There are chemical processes.
And they're the same thing.
To add to that mix, there's variation in each one of those suppliers. There's variation in their second sources. Mm-hmm, there's all kinds of variation. It's just so many. And I've seen every one of those factors play in a product.
And then that keeps us in business.
Which one's the dominant one? Well, yeah. But I think that's why I believe the most efficient approach has always been to test to some limits, combined some testing to empirical strength limits is the most efficient way, but yet
it doesn't quantify it. It doesn't tell you it's going to last 2 years or 5 years, right?
Right. And I think for semiconductor chips today, we don't know. We don't know because the dimensions and the constant progress to lower power, higher density chips is going to continue until mm-hmm. we have wires that are 2 molecules wide. I mean, getting close to that in the
nanotubes are pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we get down to those levels, new things that weren't important or other mechanisms that were not, were secondary or tertiary are now primary, you know, or become dominant. So that changes everything all the time. Yeah.
But it keeps us in business.
It keeps us
in business. We get phone calls and say, hey, how come it's breaking? It's just, well,
the gap between that knowledge of what it caused semiconductors to fail in the past mm-hmm. and what causes semiconductors to wear out. I'm talking about intrinsic mechanism. We don't have time. We cannot go and model. We cannot empirically validate these models because it's changing too fast. It's just changing too fast. And we can only say this doesn't have any apparent flaws in it. We don't know exactly, like a smartphone. If a person drops it off a 6-story building, no, we know that it's not going to probably last. Okay, it's not going to. It's going to.
You want to go try that? You got a phone, right?
I have some. Right.
We need to wrap this up. We're going to end up going 2 episodes worth of material here. So if you'd like to join, you as the listener, if you'd like to join the conversation or give us your input on it, how do you quantify this? And if somebody asks you, you know, will this phone last a year? What's the risk to our warranty or service costs or whatever for our product? How many are going to fail next month, right?
Right.
Yeah. Which are real questions that we often get asked.
Yeah. And, what's your crystal ball?
Yeah. How do you do this? You know, and please don't tell us you just make up an MTBF number and they go away happy, but that might work. I don't know.
It usually does,
unfortunately, but that's subject for another website. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. That's a page set up just to gather your input and help have you join the conversation. And we'd love to hear from you. Oftentimes the feedback we get through there ends up being the gist for the grist, whatever the right spelling is, for a new episode. So we'd love to hear from you. Have us join the conversation. Let us know what you think. I'm really interested if you agree with Kirk or with me on this one, but we'll leave it at that. So Kirk, we'll see how it pans out in the audience feedback for us. We'll see how it goes.
Okay. Sounds good, Fred.
All right. Thanks,
Kirk. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you later. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.